B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the word of God, the B-I-B-L-E.
The B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the word of God, the B-I-B-L-E.
The B-I-B-L-E. Yes, that's the book for me. I stand alone on the word.
Hey, Bob. What are you doing?
Nothing. Just cleaning up a little.
Well, good morning. Whether you are here in person or checking us out online or listening to our podcast, we are so incredibly excited that you have chosen to join us as we dive into part two of this series called The Bible for Grownups. And can I just say this? Man, sometimes I feel like we don't spend enough time acknowledging just how excited we are that you've chosen to join us online. Or maybe it's a Tuesday morning and you're riding in your car, or it's a Wednesday night and you're in front of your computer screen, you're listening to our podcast. Man, we're a church that gets excited about and that is so, so proud of being a church that's about reaching outside of our walls and what happens in the ways in which we reach into our city and reach into our world. And so the reach we have into places like Worcester, Ohio, and South Carolina, and Oklahoma, and all across this region, and even the United States of America is absolutely exciting. And so we don't want to miss an opportunity to let you know just how excited we are that you've chosen to join us. And if today is your very first time here, or maybe it's just your first time here during this entire series revolves around this tension, this concept that every single one of us at some point in our lives bump up against. And that is this. As we deal with our everyday circumstances and we deal with the people around us who have different beliefs and different worldviews, we begin to question just how valid this book is in our lives. We begin to have questions and doubts about how relevant something that was written thousands of years ago can still be relevant right here, right now, today. And whether or not this book actually is filled with truth that we can base our lives, our marriages, our parenting, our relationships in our workplace, our finances around or not. And all throughout this series, we're acknowledging this tension that many of us still hang on to the things we were told about this book as kids, as adults. But the problem is this, is that the answers we got as kids no longer suffice as adults. That just because the Bible says it, that settles it, that's no longer a good explanation for us. That's no longer good proof that this book is what it's supposed to be and that it still rings true and holds weight in our lives right here, right now, today. You see, many of us in our pursuit, in our journey of figuring out whether this book is valid and true in our lives, have this one problem. And it's a problem maybe for many of us we didn't even know it was a problem, but it's this. That many of us know some stories in the Bible. We've heard the story of Adam and Eve. We've heard David and Goliath. But very few of us actually know the story of the Bible. That we don't know how it came to be in the background, in the context to this book. And in not knowing that side of the story, what we miss is this truth. Is that oftentimes, if not always, the backstory sheds light on the story. You know that from any story you've ever heard. You know that from any life you've ever witnessed, right? then until you know the backstory, you can't fully know the story. You can't fully come to rash and critical judgments on whether the story is true and legit or not until you first know the backstory. And what I believe with all of my heart, and this is going to shock some of y'all, but what I believe with all of my heart, and it's the reason that we're doing this series, is that knowing the story of the Bible is sometimes almost as important as knowing what's written in the Bible. You see, because if we don't know the story of the Bible, it becomes ridiculously easy to discount the stories in the Bible. If we don't know how this came to be in the facts and the context of this book, there will come a point in every single one of our lives in which it becomes ridiculously easy to just fall in with the crowd and begin to discount the stories in this book. When we get introduced to the stories that we didn't talk about in Sunday school or what else this book says in it, it starts to shake our solid footing and it starts to cast doubt inside of us and it causes this slow drift away from the things in which we know are most important. But what if? What if there was an opportunity in every single one of our lives to begin, even if we've leaned out, even if we've walked away, to begin to lean in, to begin to hear something that maybe we've never heard before. You see, that's what this series is about. This series is a challenge. It's a challenge that if you have leaned out, that what would it look like for just 4 weeks just to lean in again? It's an acknowledgement that we aren't afraid to make around here. That if you have turned away from your faith, if we knew the reasons why you turned away from your faith and the stories you heard that caused you to turn away from your faith, that we probably wouldn't blame you from feeling like that was the right choice you needed to make in the moment. But if you have turned away, if you have started to drift, what if there was a side to the story you had never heard before? What if there was more that had never been explained to you in your past? What if you've continually gotten childlike answers when you've sought adult answers to these questions and doubts that you have, and you frantically search for them and come up empty? What if this was the place? What if these were the weeks in which that was a possibility in your life and in my life? And so today, we take some time to go back and recap. You see, what every single one of us need to know when it comes to this book is this, first and foremost. Jesus didn't write it. Jesus is simply the reason that we have it. Not only did Jesus not write all of it, Jesus didn't write any of it, but Jesus is the very reason that we have it. And the story of this book doesn't actually begin within the beginning. The story of this book actually begins towards the end. And the stories of guys like Matthew and Mark and Peter and Luke and John, guys who actually saw this turning point in the life of a man named Jesus. You see, for many of them, there was this underlying fear that Jesus would be just like every other wacko that they had seen come and go in the Jewish faith that testified to the fact that they were the Messiah. And you know what happened to every Messiah in the Jewish faith? He was ultimately killed at the hands of the Roman government. And there came a moment for every one of these men when these unbelievable testimonies that Jesus said about who he was looked like they were too good to be true. It was the moment where Jesus was hung up on a cross and killed by the Roman government, just like so many who had come before him. But there was this turning point, where this dead man didn't do what dead men do. He didn't stay in that grave. And there's this incredible truth that if the story would have ended on the cross, there would be no such thing as the Bible. The Bible wouldn't exist if Jesus would have stayed dead. But these guys, they saw him alive. They saw him raised from the dead. And when they saw him raised from the dead, they began to think, we can't be the only ones who hear this story. This has to be a story for the world. Everybody has to hear about what we've seen. Everybody has to see what we've seen. Everybody has to begin to believe what we believe, because this has the power not just to change our lives on this earth, but this has the ability to change our lives for eternity. And so they did the unthinkable. Because something extraordinary happened, they did something extraordinary. Many men went to work at writing the accounts of the life of this man named Jesus. And the reason why that's extraordinary is because it just didn't happen in the ancient world. We have literally zero instances of multiple writings of the same life or the same event in history. It didn't happen. It was too expensive. You had to be literate to do it. There was often a control issue with leaders and Caesars of that time in the Roman Empire, in which they wanted to pick one person so that there were no contrasting stories and so that they could control how the story was written. But here we have a story that was different, a story that many men set out to write because the story was so absolutely incredible that they had to document it. And on the heels of this absolutely incredible story, what we find is this truth. We don't believe that Jesus rose from the dead because the Bible tells us so. No, it's so much better than that. We believe Jesus rose from the dead because people saw it happen. And they believed it. And they wrote about it. And they gave their lives for it. But that wasn't the end of the story. That wasn't the end of the act. There weren't just a group of disciples or a group of followers in the first century AD that chose to give their life for it. For hundreds of years, in the middle of the Roman Empire in severe persecution, there were Christ followers who continued to make the decision. The writings, the documentation of the life of this one man is so earth-shattering and so life-changing that no matter what the Roman Empire chooses to do to us, we won't give it back to them. We won't hand these writings back over to them because the world has to hear about this. And that's where we pick up the story today. You see, for many of us, the struggle doesn't just lie in the writings of Jesus. The struggle in our belief about this book actually goes back to the very beginning. When those three words were written on paper in the beginning, and the creation account is where our holdup actually lies. It isn't so much with the writings or the life of Jesus, but it's about what happened at the beginning. And how valid and how true is that? And how can we back that up in light of science? And today we have to move forward in order to go back. You see, around the same time period in which Matthew, Mark, and Luke were writing their gospel, we pick up the story of this guy named Paul. Some of us have heard of Paul before. But Paul's mission in his life was to take this story of Jesus out into the entire Roman and Greek world. His mission in life was to take the story and the life-changing message of Jesus to the Gentiles. And as Paul set out on this mission to take this story of Jesus to the Gentiles, what he quickly began to learn was this, is that in every presentation of this life that he made to every Greek and Roman in his life, there were these two roadblocks that he faced time and time again. The first roadblock was this. Is that as he walked into the Roman and Greek world, what he found is that this concept and this belief in one God was foreign to them. They had spent their entire lives living according to a multiple God system. In fact, dependent upon the region of Rome in which you lived or the region of the Roman Empire in which you lived, you would have totally different gods. This region had certain gods, this region had certain gods, this region had certain gods, and they even elevated ancestors to godlike levels. And so you would build shrines and you would worship your ancestors. This father, this great-great-great-great-grandfather who changed our family dynamic, they are now godlike and we worship them. And all along the way in the Greek and Roman world, as he began to present this thing called Christianity and following this man named Jesus, he began to run into this roadblock where Gentiles struggled with the belief that there could possibly be but one God. You see, the Roman Empire didn't care who you worshiped or how many gods you worshiped. As long as you were simply a good Greek or Roman citizen that paid homage to Caesar and offered sacrifices to the Roman gods. If you did those things, you could do whatever else you wanted to do, worship whoever else you wanted to worship. But along came these Christ followers, these Christians, and they began to buck the trend. They began to say, no, we're not going to bow down to Caesar, and we're not going to offer sacrifices to the Roman gods. And like we talked about last week, that caused an instant issue because the Greek and Roman world, as Stevie Wonder said, was, help me out, very superstitious. You're supposed to sing it, y'all. And because they were superstitious, anything wrong that happened, there had to be somebody at fault. And who was the easy target? The people who weren't doing what good Roman and Greek citizens should do. The people who weren't bowing down to Caesar, the people who weren't offering sacrifices to the gods. The reason there's no rain, the reason the crops aren't growing, is because y'all aren't doing what you're supposed to do, and now the gods are mad at all of us, and it's your fault. And because of that, Paul found himself bumping into roadblock number two. And that was, there was this roadblock around, if we follow this guy named Jesus, what kind of persecution are we going to face at the hands of the Roman government? And as I thought about that, you ever read scripture before and these squirrels just run through your head? Maybe you're nothing like me. But I question as I read through the New Testament and I hear the stories of the persecution that these Christ followers faced. You know what I thought of? Why in the world were the Jews not really persecuted? But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this new way rises up that's pretty much like the Jewish religion. It was based off of the origins of the Jewish religion. And all of a sudden, the Roman Empire took issue with it. And there was heavy persecution. I mean, read the stories of Nero, right? Nero would throw parties out in his garden. You know what he thought was funny and cool? Let's round up some Christians, tie them to the trees, and we'll make candles for our parties out of Christians. That's what they were facing around this time. And I question, like, why did that happen? Well, here's why. This is the historical context. The reason why that happened is because ancient Greek and Roman culture was predicated on honoring ancient things. And what they recognized was this, is that the Jewish religion predated any Roman or Greek mythology. That it was more ancient than any religion that they presently had. And so because of that, because it was ancient and their society was predicated on honoring ancient things, the Jews got a pass. But whoa. If you're going to follow some dude who we've rubbed shoulders with, it's no longer ancient anymore. And you're fair game to be the one that we point the finger at and we blame for everything that's wrong right now in our society. But what's so incredible is this. Is that in light of those two roadblocks, Gentile after Gentile found the story of Jesus so compelling and so life-changing that they found themselves one by one jumping over every roadblock to encounter this man named Jesus, to begin to engage in the story of the life of this man that actually happened, a dead man that didn't stay dead and has the power to do the exact same thing in our lives. And when the Gentiles became enamored with one particular Jew, who's that? Not a trick question. Jesus, they became enamored with the ancient Jewish text. They became enamored with these writings, the law and the prophets, not the Old Testament yet, the law and the prophets that pointed or supposedly pointed to this man named Jesus. And they had this interest in finding Jesus in the text. Now, here's something critical for all of us to know. The Gentiles were not interested in Judaism. In fact, none of the Roman or Greek world wanted anything to do with anything that was Jewish. Jews had this reputation for keeping to themselves. There were pockets of Jews all over the Roman Empire. And you know what? Jews did not associate with outsiders. If you were not a part of the Jewish religious system, you did not get to be a part of my life. And so they didn't associate, and many Gentiles knew nothing about anything or anyone who was Jewish. In fact, we know this. This is absolutely crazy to me. I told you last week, I warned you with this expectation that this is going to be hot and heavy, and it's going to be a little bit different than what we normally do around here. But unless we know and can believe in this book, we can't fully apply this book. But I geek out about the history stuff. But here's what we know for a fact about Peter, the guy who Jesus said, "On you, I'm going to build my church." We know that up to 15 years after the resurrection, Peter still had never set foot in a Gentile's house. And most likely had never invited a Gentile to step foot in his house either. This was just how the ancient Roman world worked. They didn't cross paths. They didn't mingle with each other. And then out of nowhere, they began to encounter this text that pointed to Jesus, and they began to dive in head first and trying to find, did these ancient texts actually point to this man who we've seen and we've rubbed shoulders with and who lived in our midst right here, right now? And when they dove head first into these ancient texts, here's what they found. That this new and novel way of thinking, or at least so they thought was a new and novel way of thinking, that there was only one God, what they thought they were following when they were giving their lives to Christ, this was not actually new or novel at all. This was something that predated every single Greek or Roman religious system, every religious system in the world, that this had been around, that maybe, just maybe, the Jews had been onto something and had known all along that there was always just one God. You see, when they began to go looking for Jesus in these ancient texts, there were things right from the get-go that smacked them right in the forehead, that changed their lives, that changed their worldview. And maybe this morning it's the same with you, that you've read some of these things 100 times, you grew up in the church and you've heard these stories 1,000 times, but you haven't fully immersed yourself into what is actually taking place. And today, just like it has for me, it has the potential to absolutely blow your mind and give you solid footing on this book and the way in which it impacts our lives. You see, when these Gentiles cracked open those ancient scrolls and they began reading, what they found in the very first sentence was something that altered their lives. This morning, we're going to jump into the book of Genesis, chapter 1, and we're going to spend the majority of our time right in that book. If you haven't done so already, it's a perfect opportunity for you to grab your weekly, crack it open, and on the inside, you'll find a notes page that we've designed for you. It'll help you follow along as we move through the text. Everything will come up on the screen for you as well. You can even grab a pen from the seat back in front of you and fill in some blanks as we go of some incredible things that'll help you as you struggle with the validity of this book in the weeks and the months to come. But as they crack open these ancient scrolls, here's what they see at the very start. In Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, Moses writes this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. From the very beginning, what we often pass over, having grown up in the church or having heard this story before, is how absolutely different these first 4 words are to any Gentile that heard this. In the beginning, and it all became singular in a moment. In the beginning, God. Do you know what the creation myth that every Gentile, every Roman and Greek citizen had always heard? Do you know how they went? In the beginning, the gods were at war with each other. The gods were fighting for control in this area. The gods were doing this. The gods were fighting here. The gods were making slaves over here. That's the creation account that they had been accustomed to. But in the beginning, God, this origin story, that's what Genesis means. Maybe that's one thing you take home if it's the only thing you learned this morning. Genesis is origin. This origin story was vastly different than anything they had heard before. But nearly 1,800 years later, something happened in the scientific world that had the potential to absolutely wreck your faith and my faith. About 1,800 years later, there was this archaeological discovery where scientists began to uncover the creation stories and ancient texts written by the Babylonians and the Canaanites and the Egyptians and the Sumerians. And as they uncovered these ancient texts, these ancient creation stories, what they began to find, and at face value, what it seemed like was these creation accounts were vastly similar to the origin story that we read in Genesis. And the conclusion that they began to make was this: because all of these were written around the same time period, and maybe even the Babylonian and some of the Canaanite origin stories were written before Moses actually put pen to paper in the Genesis account of the Jewish religion, maybe, just maybe, that the Genesis account was stolen from all the rest. Because it was so similar, if nothing else, the Genesis account borrowed from those other accounts. And some of y'all, you're sitting there and you're like, Ben, you weren't supposed to muddy the water more for me. Now you're bringing up all these archaeological and scientific things. You already knew I walked in here struggling, and you're going to tell me just a couple hundred years ago they began to uncover things and scientists began to believe that the Genesis story wasn't unique and was probably stolen from something else. You didn't let me finish. The crazy part is this. A couple hundred years later, that scientific theory has been completely abandoned by the scientific world. Why? Because as they began to dive deeper into the Genesis account, what they began to discover was this: is that the story of creation written in Genesis is not anything like the Babylonian creation account, is not anything like the Canaanite creation account, is not anything like the Egyptian creation account, is not anything like the Sumerian creation account. What they began to uncover in these moments over the course of the last century as they abandoned it in the scientific field one by one is that Genesis was creating a worldview unto itself. Genesis was creating a worldview that had never been put out there before. And this Genesis worldview was so extraordinary and so ahead of its time. So much so that the world of science would not catch up with this belief until the middle of the 20th century. In 1927, there was this European priest who proposed this theory of the creation of the world. Maybe some of y'all have heard it before. It's the theory, and for some of us who have grown up in the church, it makes us shake just a little bit. It's the Big Bang Theory. Y'all heard of that before? And it was this thought that the world was created in an instant. You see, up until this point in time, dating all the way back to the 4th century BC, there was this dude named Aristotle. We've heard of Aristotle, right? Who proposed this theory that had been held onto in the scientific world for nearly 2,300 years. This scientific theory that the world just always was. That's what the scientific community held on to. That the world was just always there. But then one day there was the discovery of this thing called the cosmic microwave radiation. Y'all heard that in science class before? And in the discovery of this cosmic microwave radiation, there was this new fact: that in 1 trillionth of a second, the universe went from the size of a pebble into its present astronomical size. You want to talk about a theory that should not make us as the church shake in our boots? This is it. Because do you know what this points to? This points to the reality that there was a, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In 1 trillionth of a second, we have a God who snapped his finger and what wasn't became what was. A scientific fact that points to this, and we're about to go just a little bit deeper, y'all, so hang on just a second, that points to this incredible fact that everything that has a beginning has a cause. everything that has a beginning has a purpose. Now, what comes next in Genesis is lost on us. Because the significance of what is happening, the statement that Moses is trying to make, is just assumed by us. We've grown up in church, or we've heard enough stories, or we have just enough belief that we just assume that God created the heavens and the earth. And so we just assume that that statement is true. Where our issue comes in is how it all happened, or how long ago it all happened. But because we just assume that God created it, what we miss is this fact, is that when Moses was penning Genesis, Moses is trying to build a case that's no longer needed. Moses is trying to build a case that's overlooked in the 21st century, because his argument ultimately succeeded. Moses' argument ultimately succeeded. We just assume that the creation happened by God. And because we just naturally assume that creation by God happened, but we'll debate what happened after that, our natural tendency is to go to this. That Moses' primary purpose was to tell us how God created the world. That's why he penned this, right? To give us clear explanations on how all of this happened and how all the details are accurate. But hear this. That was never Moses' primary reason for writing this account. Hello. Y'all okay? Y'all good churchgoers like me, okay? Your heart have a little palpitation there? Moses' primary purpose in writing this book was not to explain how God created the world. Moses' primary purpose in writing this book was to convince Gentiles that a God created this world. Was to convince Gentiles who had always simply heard stories about the gods and what the gods were doing, and Gentiles who had never heard such a thing, that there was a singular God, a bigger God, a better God, a more loving God, a God who had an incredible cause and purpose for this world, and you were the major part of that cause and purpose. That concept was foreign to the Gentiles. Why? Because the Gentiles had grown up on creation stories like the Babylonian creation story, centered on the god named Marduk. Maybe you've never heard of Marduk before, so let me give you just a brief story of Marduk. Marduk is the Babylonian god. And Marduk rises to power as the primary god in this way. This is how the fable is told. Marduk has a chariot of four horses. And as he's trying to assume power as the greatest god, he dismounts from his chariot and rides astride on top of his two horses, one of them by the name of Merciless. And he approaches this female goddess and he shoots her through the mouth with an arrow. And as he approaches her astride on his two horses, he cuts her in half. And with the top half, he creates the heavens. And with the bottom half, he creates the earth. You want to talk about some kids who never miss Sunday school class, the Babylonian kids, right? There's some intense stuff. Like, I want to hear that story. What's going on there? But in this story of Marduk, what ultimately happens is there's always the creation of mankind. But much like the Babylonian creation story, what we find is this. The creation of man in the Enuma Elish, that's this Babylonian creation story, much like all of the rest. The creation of man comes onto the pages in about book 5. And the creation of man has but one purpose. One purpose that Marduk outlines perfectly. Check out what's written in the Enuma Elish. Marduk says, "For I will establish a savage. Man shall be his name. Savage man I will create. He will be charged with the service of the gods, that they might be at ease." You see, in every single ancient creation myth, mankind is an afterthought. In every single ancient creation myth, mankind's purpose was to lighten the load of the gods so that they didn't have to do anything. Mankind, and especially womankind, had no value, no worth, no identity on this earth. And furthermore, the violence and injustice of mankind was justified because that's how all the gods acted. Mankind was allowed to do whatever violent and injustice act they wanted because we were simply replicating what our fathers in heaven were doing. But then we come to Genesis, and it stands in stark contrast to all the rest of the creation stories and creation myths. We come to this part in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Moses writes, "Then God said, 'Let us make human beings in our image to be like us.'" See, in the creation story, man is the pinnacle of creation, not the afterthought. Dignity for every man, woman, and child was established in the beginning. There is no comparison to that. There is no other God like that that made us as mankind the greatest part of the creation story. Above all the heavens, above all the earth, above all things that walk on this earth, above the stars and the sky and every Milky Way and every formation out there, that the pinnacle of creation was lowly me. Was insignificant me. No other God made that statement. No other God followed that formula. No other story claimed to be like that. But it doesn't end there. He continues in verse 26, "For they," meaning us as mankind, "will reign over the fish in the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the wild animals on the earth, and the small animals that scurry along the ground." You see, this concept was and still is absolutely unimaginable. Forever, every other Greek and Roman and Babylonian and Canaanite and Egyptian religion, it was all predicated on nature and animals were above us as mankind. It's the reason why when you pick up this book and you read about the struggles in the Old Testament, where do they always revert back to? They always revert back to making idols and statues to stupid things like cows and different gods and goddesses of nature. Because that's how all the other Gentile religions were formulated. But this one was different. You weren't made to be beneath them. You were made to reign over them, to rule them. I've entrusted you with responsibility. I've given you dominion over this earth. That's the value, the worth, the identity, the greatness that I see in you as mankind. But God didn't even stop there. In verse 27, "So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and," help me out, "female." He created them. Now come back for just a second. This very moment in the beginning, it's the reason why I believe with all of my heart that every single woman should be a Christ follower. Because in this very moment, in the very beginning, God gave every woman value and worth and identity that the world still hasn't adequately been able to come to grips with. That the world around us has just barely started to be able to have real and relevant conversations around this proclamation that was made thousands of years ago at the creation of us. You see, Jesus was the first one to introduce an elevation of status in womankind, but it wasn't Jesus who introduced this. It was there in the beginning. In the beginning. God looked at every single one of us and said, "You are my image bearer. I think so highly of you that when I formed you together, I put a piece of myself in you. There's no other religion in the world. There's no other God who is willing to go to that extent. You want to talk about the golden rule? The golden rule wasn't introduced in the New Testament. The golden rule was introduced when God said, I have created you as my image bearer. And what that means is when you look at another human being, you should be looking at me. The way in which you treat somebody else is the way in which you should treat me. The way in which you love others, you should be acting as if you're loving me. It all started in the beginning. But there's more. Heard me say that before this morning? God didn't stop at that. What we see in the creation account as well is this, is that God loved us so much that he gave you the ability to choose your own way. He gave us the ability to make our own choices, and he let it happen. Parents, think about that for a moment. For those of us in this room who are parents, if you were given the opportunity for the rest of your child's life to make every decision for them, most of us would say, sign me up. My kids are going to make some dumb choices, and I want to save them from that. I want to keep that from happening. They're not smart enough to make their own choices. They're not smart enough to know what I know. And so if I had a chance to control, sign me up for that, baby. I want to protect my kids. I want them to choose the right thing. But God loved us so much that he said, no, I don't want my kids to be robots. I want them to be able to make their own choice. And what's so absolutely fascinating, it's why I do what I do, is a God like that who is willing to give us our own choice, to turn our back on him. You know what else he did? He went to work writing a story of redemption and saving. Saving us in the moments where we turned our back on him. A story of a God doing something that was so ungodly. The gods of the Roman and the Greek world did not do this. This was not a thought. This was not even a possibility. But we have the story of a God who worked to redeem humanity's choice to go against him, to fix what we broke, to show his love in that incredible way, that even if you want nothing to do with me, I'm working my butt off to try to save you, to try to prove my love to you, to try to get you to choose the right way. We come full circle. It's what Paul writes to the Gentiles in Galatians chapter 3. Paul writes, but Christ has rescued us from the curse pronounced by the law. Hey, Gentiles, when you go back and read about what mankind got when we chose to sin, when we chose to turn our backs on God, God sent his son, Christ, to rescue us from that curse that we were due, that we were deserved. When he was hung on the cross, he took upon himself the curse for our wrongdoing. Through Christ Jesus, God has blessed the Gentiles. Every single one of us with the same blessing he promised to Abraham. You see, here's where we finish. The problem for many of us lies here. Is that when we go back to the story of in the beginning, we find ourselves getting so hung up on how did the creation happen? How accurate is the account? How long ago was it? How much can that be believed? And we get so hung up on that had to be Moses' primary purpose in writing this book, is to describe in perfect detail how this all came about, because it's just assumed that God created it. And what we miss is that that was never Moses' primary purpose. Moses' primary purpose was to describe to the Gentiles every why question that ever popped into their mind. Why is there something instead of nothing? Why do I matter? Why am I here? Moses' primary purpose in writing this book was this: to show every person in humankind, that you weren't created to lighten the loads of gods. You were not created randomly by the universe. You're not a result of some cosmic conflict. No. You were created as image bearers. And you were so important to God that when the moment was right, he chose to join us. Isn't that incredible? You can search the world and you'll never find a God like that. You'll never find a story of love like that. But I get it. Some of us find ourselves saying, no dude is going to walk up on this stage for 40 minutes and give me a different side of the picture and tell me that the how isn't important and that the how isn't still a holdup to whether or not I can believe that this book is relevant and real and truthful or not. And if you find yourself still in that place, still wanting to sway over to the purpose has to be the how it was done, then I want to give you a resource. There's a book written by a guy named John Lennox, absolutely incredible. He's an incredible author who has done so much work in bringing together what we have for so long believed has to be separate, and that is the scientific world and our faith. And he wrote this book. It's not that big, y'all. This book called 7 Days That Divide the World. And it's an absolutely incredible resource that literally you can read a chapter of this in like 7-8 minutes. But we'll begin to answer some of those holdups and address some of those tensions if you're still questioning the how and can science and creation go together. And so I'd challenge you, if you're still struggling with that, to hop onto Amazon and to grab yourself a copy. Here's the good news. If there's still more in your mind, and answering the question of Jesus and him raising from the dead and the ways in which that story came about and was written and lives were given for it doesn't fully get you there. And a different side of in the beginning that contrasts and creates a worldview that is unlike any other, that proves a love unlike any other, doesn't quite get you there. The good news is this. We've only gotten through part 2. Next week, we push on to part 3. And if you find yourself in the boat of like, man, I don't know how to justify what we're walking through in the world right now in light of some of the stuff I read in the Old Testament and some of the stories of God's judgment and everything that's going on there, I don't know how those two can correlate with one another. Part 3 is a week that you do not want to miss. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for an account of your creation that is unrivaled. A story that is filled with things we have so often overlooked that prove that we, as your creation, were not an afterthought. We weren't created without a purpose. We weren't some game to the gods or random chance of the universe. We were created on purpose, for a purpose. That we were part of the central purpose of your creation. Male, female, child, you gave us value, identity, and worth in the beginning. And in the beginning, when we chose to go our own way, you went to work on a redemption solution. God, we thank you for that love. We thank you for who you are. We thank you for your power that in 1 trillion trillionth of a second, you came and made this all the way it is. It blows my mind how a God who's that big can care about little me and love me and all my imperfections, but you do. For that, we thank you. It's in your name that we pray. Amen. Like Russell said at the beginning, Man, if you're here for the very first time this morning, or you're back for the first time in a really long time, man, we'd love to give you something just to say thank you this morning. We promise no strings attached, no awkward conversations. We'd love as you head out for you to simply stop at the Connections booth in the corner of our lobby, and we've got a first-time visitor pack that we'd love to give you, full of some core swag as well as some more information about us. But let me just finish with this again. I'll be redundant. As we progress through this series, this journey, what I believe with all of my heart is that as summer sets in and the warmer weather sets in, there's this pull in all of us of like, man, we want to be outside. We want to be at the lake. We want to be doing these things. But what I believe with all of my heart is that this series has incredible power and gives us the footing to be able to believe this book and then apply this book in every facet of our lives. But this book and this story and this journey that we're on, I believe isn't just about you. That next week there's somebody in your life who is struggling, who has walked away because of some of the things they've read in this book or heard about the Old Testament that needs to be here. It needs to hear a different side of the story. And I'm asking you, what would it look like for you to invite them to be here for part 3 of the Bible for Grownups? Again, thanks so much for being with us this morning. Have a great rest of your Sunday. We hope to see you soon.